WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Pete Townsend, the co-founder of The Who, turned 55 today. The surviving members of the band are reuniting for a summer tour. Let's get back to our 1993 interview with Townsend.
Now, let me ask you about the beginnings of your music. Having come to rock and roll after being interested in jazz, after having played guitar, after having worshipped your father who played clarinet, when you started playing rock and roll, you really cranked up the volume and started using feedback and distortion, getting really far away from the sounds you were first interested in. Tell me why you became so interested in volume and distortion.
Well, there are a couple of different things. I mean, there's a sort of a sociologist in me on this subject, and I think and if I can actually talk about Jim Marshall as an example here, I won't talk about me. Let me talk about Jim Marshall. Jim Marshall's father was a boxer. Jim Marshall is the man who invented the Marshall amplifier, you know, the big stack that The Who used, that mm-hmm. Eric Clapton used, that Jimi Hendrix adopted when he came to the UK, that big wall of sound thing. And Jim had a music shop, and one day I went in, and we'd been playing at pubs, and I said, I've got these two American amplifiers, Jim. I've got a Fender Pro Amp and a Fender Bassman Amp, and I said, they're great amplifiers, they sound great. And I was already using a certain amount of feedback. And I said, but the trouble is that I can hear the audience. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, I can hear them. You know, I mean, if I'm playing and somebody's in the front row and they say, this is junk, I can hear what they're saying. I don't want to hear them, okay? And I said, so I need something bigger and louder. And his eyes lit up. And I said, can you do this for me? And he said, and he got his engineer out and he said, do you think you can do this? And the guy said, yeah, I think I can do it. You know, I can do it. I could think I can do it. And I realized at that moment that what was actually happening was that I was demanding a more powerful machine gun. And Jim Marshall was going to build it for me. And then we were going to go out and blow people away all around the world. And the generation we were going to blow away was the generation immediately preceding us, the ones who had the gall to tell us that we were wimps because we had long hair, wimps because we didn't have wars to fight in, wimps because we couldn't prove ourselves in military service because we didn't have it, you know, it was not necessary anymore. We were post-atomic bomb people, that we were wimps, 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 and that the only reason that we even had electric guitars and rock and roll was because they'd paved the way for peace and given everything up, which is, of course, absolutely true they had. You know, and Remembrance Day is a day that I take very seriously. You know, I do remember those guys that gave us this peace, and I cry for them. But I think that anger was something that really crossed over generations. It wasn't just from rock and roll. It just wasn't from me and my need to smash guitars. It was right over the whole industry, right through the whole of show business and rock and roll and the media and everybody. Everybody of that generation wanted it to be bigger, louder, and wanted it to be as big as the atomic bomb had been.
Now, how do you connect this to smashing guitars?
I think the connection isn't actually, you would call it in CD-ROM talk, you would call it a hyperlink. I don't think it's a direct connection. Mm-hmm. I think it's a byproduct of stage performance. I think, you know, you know, the first guitar that I broke in front of my grandmother, you know, when I was 14.
Were you impressing her, or was this a mistake?
No. It was another take on the Jim Marshall story. She bought me my first guitar, which was a piece of trash. Uh-huh. And I was very upset because my father had recommended the guitar because I couldn't play the clarinet, and I wanted him to buy the guitar. So I was angry that she bought me this piece of trash, and it was very, very hard to play. And my dad said, well, you know, she has bought it for you. She is your grandmother. Try and learn to play something on it. And if you can, then I'll buy you a new one. And this went on and on and on and on. And one day I'm clunking away at this horrible kind of guitar, which was really fit only to be hung on the wall at an Italian restaurant next to the Chianti bottles. And I think that's where it probably came from. And she came in and she said, this is a bloody awful row. You know, why don't you play some proper music? And I said, listen, Nan, it's, you know, it's, we know what we're doing, you know, leave us alone. And I was with John Entwistle, who was, you know, we were little kids, really. And she said, no, turn it off. It's a bloody horrible row. So, and she said, if you don't turn it off, I'll smash it. So I said, no, you won't smash it. And I got the guitar, and I smashed it over the amplifier. I broke an amplifier at the same time too, a little kind of tiny amplifier. And she went completely white and walked out of the room. And John said, you've done it now. And I said, I might have. I said, but John, I feel great. And of course, I was able then to, you know, to go and look for a decent guitar and rob and steal to get it, which is what I did, and found myself a decent instrument. And from there on, I never looked back. Really.
Yeah, but once you had a good instrument, why did you smash that on stage?
Guitars are very good for me to express myself by smashing them.
Mm-hmm.
They're very good for me to express myself by playing them. They're very good for express myself by pouring lighter fluid over them and warming my hands. You know, it depends what I'm doing. You know.
But let me ask you, how did the feeling you had the first time you smashed a guitar on stage compare to the feeling you had like the 100th time or the 200th time you'd done it? Did it still feel as good? Did it feel good in a different way?
I don't think it's ever felt good at all. I don't think it's something that I expected to feel good.
I mean, good in the sense of a release.
I don't think it's ever felt good as a sense of a release. I don't, you know, it's always been too, you know, I've always used the instrument that I happen to be playing at the time. And I mean, as I see it splinter, I'm thinking, oh my God, $1,000. But, you know, I've actually been enough of an artist and believed in the act enough to do it again and again and again.
Well, what does the act mean to you?
It means a number of things. I think it's a statement mainly of artistic independence. I mean, it's also an act of, it's in the same tone as, you know, as you know, we want our amplifiers to be loud so that we can't hear the response. It's like saying, okay, the show is over. Now, I am finished. And in a sense that all music is over now, everything to do with this particular event is over now. It's finished. You know, the interaction between me, you and this guitar is over now. It's a big dramatic action. And the reason that it has to, in a way, be theatrically violent, because I think that's as far as it gets. It's, you know, we used to smash our equipment up and then go back and drink, you know, cups of lemon tea. Like, I think that the reason that it needs to be theatrically violent is in a way that it is because the observation that the thing that we're trying, you know, get out of the you know to the response that we want from the audience is one of absolute reflection at that moment on everything that's happened up to that point. You know, to stun them, to actually stop them.
Well, I really wish we had more time to talk, but we have to wrap up. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
For being with us.
Pete Townsend recorded in 1993. Today is his 55th birthday. The surviving members of The Who will reunite for a summer tour that begins June 25th. Townsend's new CD, Lifehouse Elements, will be released next week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Elliot Smith emerged from cult status a couple of years ago when one of his songs from the soundtrack to Good Will Hunting was nominated for an Oscar. He has a new CD called Figure Eight, which is getting rave reviews. Our rock critic Ken Tucker listened to it and finds similarities to an older, now less fashionable singer-songwriter, Jules Shear, who also has a new CD. Here's Ken's review of both.
I had tender feelings that you made hard, but it's your heart, not mine, that's scarred. So when I go home, I'll be happy to go.
You're just somebody that I used to know.
Elliott Smith, with his wimpy voice and iron-willed sentiments, is very much in favor in rock press circles these days. A new song like that one, called Somebody That I Used to Know, can be praised for the way its pretty melody and delicately sung vocal contrasts dramatically with the angry dismissal of its lyrics. It's a formula that Smith uses to good effect throughout his CD, Figure Eight, as on this pretty bit of despair, Everything Means Nothing to Me.
Someone found the future as a statue in a fountain, and attention looking backward in a pool of water, wishes with a blue songbird on his shoulder, who keeps singing over everything. Everything means nothing to me. Everything means nothing to me. Everything means nothing to me.
In reviews of Figure Eight, Elliott Smith is being compared to the Beatles and dubbed the Brian Wilson of grunge. All pretty meaningless, but nonetheless redolent of high praise. I remember trying to hype a somewhat similar artist in similar terms almost two decades ago, when Jules Shear was leading a Los Angeles rock band called Jules and the Polar Bears. As you can hear on Shear's brand new solo album called Allow Me, Elliott Smith has nothing on Shear when it comes to passion empowered by whininess.
Chilly morning sneaks up my shirt cuffs. I see you drinking coffee, looking pretty rough. Say you're out with your best friends, cigarettes and caffeine. But you neglect to mention you're your own worst enemy. You don't have to beat yourself up to live. It's hard.
When I accuse Jules Shear of whininess, I do it as an affectionate joke. In fact, I love his singing. It's my favorite kind of rock vocalizing, in which the technical limitations of the singer actually enhance the pure emotions he's trying to put across. Plus, Shear has a knack for catchy melodies that a comparative kid like Elliott Smith ought to envy. Just listen to Shear's The More That I'm Around You. While Elliott Smith can eloquently dismiss a lover as somebody that I used to know and press upon you the implication that he rejected her, Jules Shear knows that the heart and soul of the best whiny rock is to candidly admit that she has rejected you, and he bemoans his dumped status by reiterating his devotion. If I've been harder on Elliott Smith than Jules Shear here, it's just that I know Shear's CD is never going to get the attention that Smith's already has. Shear has been around too long to be a hit media fave. In the end, I think it'll all even out. The majority of record buyers go for guys with better voices than either of these men. But for now, I'm pulling for the underdog. For anyone who reads a rave Elliott Smith review, I urge you to go out and buy Shear's Allow Me. After all, Jules Shear wrote the best song the Bangles ever recorded, If She Knew What She Wants. The new millennium equivalent would be Elliott Smith writing good material for Britney Spears. Fat chance of that.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Figure Eight by Elliott Smith and Allow Me by Jules Shear. Here's Shear singing his song If She Knew What She Wants from an earlier CD.
If she knew what she wants, if she knew what she needs, if she knew what she wants, if she knew what she wants, I'd be giving it to her, giving it to her. But she wants everything, well, there's nothing she wants. I'm crazy for this girl. If she knew what she wants, I'd be giving it to her, giving it to her. Now I'd say her values aren't corrupted and she's open to change. But one day she's satisfied and the next I find her crying, and it's nothing she can explain. If she knew what she wants, if she knew.
Coming up, films that specialized in bad taste and social satire. We remember screenwriter, director, and actor Paul Bartel. He died Saturday at the age of 61. This is Fresh Air.